is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis. Headline from the London paper, the London Times. Ukraine peace talks. Russia says it will ease assault on Kyiv, the capital. Kremlin promises to, quote, radically scale back attacks as negotiations continue. I've spoken with Kyiv several times over the last 2 weeks, and the siege of Kyiv is odd to listen to from the outside. You can hear an air raid siren now and again, but the south of the city is open. The train travel from Lviv to Kyiv is open. The electricity, the internet, the water, everything remains. The infrastructure is intact, but there are no people, or all the vulnerable people have left the city. Instead, it's populated by territorial defenders, volunteers, accountants, bankers, truck drivers, volunteering with AK-47s and not enough flak jackets. And then to the northwest of the city, the Ukrainian army dug in what sound to be trenches against the Russians, who continue to throw waves of conscripts against heavy firepower, taking huge casualties. That's the siege I've listened to for the last 2 weeks. And now, and the Russians, of course, lobbing shells and missiles in at night against residential towers, hardly what you call an effective assault. Now we hear that the Russians are going to scale back. Where is this taking us? I welcome Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, to comment on this headline. It's fog of war. It could or could not be accurate. But there's also much reporting about peace talks in Istanbul, conversation from Ukrainian authorities to Russian authorities. Gregory, the war in Ukraine, the surprising fact is Russia is in some way changing its posture, and London is preparing with different metaphors. Right now, I'll just use one. Is Russia winding down its assaults in Ukraine? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, the reality is, of course, that we have been describing the Russian invasion of Ukraine from a Western perspective, from the perspective of this is what we would do, therefore the Russians must be doing it. The reality is that the Russians were never engaged in a full-scale invasion. You don't do that with 190,000 troops against a population of 45 million. And Moscow knew that. The point was to put pressure on Kyiv to negotiate. And this was why Kyiv and most of the major Ukrainian cities were never actually fully targeted by the Russian forces. They were given a lot of pressure. They were given the urge to negotiate, to show in essence how defenseless Ukraine was against Russia if Russia decided to move at its full pace. The stories of the gallant defenders of Kyiv are highly overrated and dramatized. Yes, there are casualties occurring, but not waves of conscripts being thrown against the gallant Ukrainian defenders. This is part of the propaganda campaign on the Ukrainian side. The reality is that Russia has achieved what it wants to achieve. It got President Zelensky of Ukraine to agree to negotiate and agree to the reality that that Ukraine would not become part of NATO, which was the underlying assumption of the Russian invasion. And had Zelensky taken the hint on January 26th or so, he could have avoided the Russian invasion altogether, but he thought he could get away with it. He thought at that stage still that the United States and NATO would somehow back him. Now, what on January 25th we saw President Biden doing was literally sending a direct, unambiguous message to Moscow to say, we are pulling our advisors out. We will not engage U.S. troops in the defense of Ukraine. If you Moscow decide to go in, there will be some sanction penalties. But apart from that, sort this problem out once and for all. But the reality is, we can't, as Washington, acknowledge that we would withdraw our support for a Ukraine in NATO. So basically, everyone thought that was a slip of the tongue by President Biden, but the State Department kept reiterating that message over the coming days. At that point, most of President Zelensky's cabinet understood We've been thrown under a bus. The Americans and NATO are not going to save us, and neither is the European Union. We need to negotiate with Moscow. But Zelensky, inexperienced and possibly not operating with his full faculty on this topic, said, no, our constitution says that we must be a member of NATO and the European Union. Therefore, cancel everything that the ministers have said. We will not negotiate. Well, that was foolhardy. And of course, a month later, he's come to his senses after the deaths of so many of his countrymen. The reality is that Moscow is very clear about what it wants. It needs all of Donbass restored to those republics, which are, yes, they're Russian-speaking, but they're not actually Russian in mentality. They're somewhere between the Ukrainians and the Russians, but they don't want to be part of Ukraine because they've been persecuted for a long period by Kiev and the like. So they want to be independent. Fine. Russia's going to help them to do that because that would be a great buffer for Russia, and it would restore the productivity of the Donbass region as well, which would help Russia. Russia also wants, of course, to link the Crimean enclave up with Donetsk, People's Republic, so they would then control all of the coast of the Sea of Azov. That would be their ideal. That would deny that to Western Ukraine. And basically, you'd have a settlement on that basis. The unfortunate thing for Moscow was that the U.S. Jingoism literally has created a panic in Europe, particularly. I was just in Rome and Istanbul for meetings, and the hysteria there is that Russia is now back to a position of being worse than the Soviet Union. So this has driven, of course, Moscow fully into the arms of Beijing, and that's going to cause a problem for the Western world for the next decade or more.
We're going to head to Beijing, but just a moment here about the NATO. NATO is now making statements that suggest it's reawakened, or it's awakened for the first time. Do you measure those as sincere, especially about its commitment to expanding its military purchase?
Well, Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, who just got his job saved by this whole event, and he's now had his contract extended by a year, he's been pushing for support for Ukraine as being the essential element of the need to revive NATO. Yes, the NATO member countries mostly have agreed to increase their defense spending, but in fact, their real measure of effectiveness is their how they can become interoperable with each other. That's what was achieved in the 70s and 80s when NATO went through what we call its RSI phase, its rationalization, standardization, and interoperability phase, where they made sure they all had the same sort of equipment, they could all speak to each other, could all have coordinated doctrine and operational practices. That's gone. NATO is no longer a cohesive military force, even if the Germans treble, as they're planning to do, their defense spending. This is not going to make it necessarily a viable alliance. And in any event, what's the alliance for? It's protect against the Soviet Union originally, and now what? To protect against Russia? Russia has not moved to advance against the West since the end of the Cold War. On the contrary, NATO has expanded against Russia, which was exactly what President Reagan and Prime Minister Thatcher promised Russia that the West would not do. So, yes, we've seen that there was a deliberate attempt in the last year, particularly the last few months, to make Ukraine an issue, to literally force Moscow into doing something about Ukraine, which it's done. And that chapter is coming to a close. The question is, what are the ramifications going to be in terms of global strategy? Because we've now repolarized the world to look like Cold War One. So Cold War Two bears an uncanny resemblance to Cold War One because we've got this Eurasian bloc versus a maritime bloc in the West. And it was in 1972, of course, when we moved with Nixon's visit to Beijing to break up that bloc. And that was successful, and it helped end the Cold War. But then we go and recreate this solid Eurasian bloc again because Russia has nowhere else to go. And it has saved the People's Republic of China and the Communist Party of China. The Communist Party of China was existentially dependent on U.S. food. Now they can end that dependency on US food and start taking all of the food output and surpluses, which are now massive, from the next big grain superpower, which is Russia, and they can get that grain into China at a lower price. They can also get Russian oil and gas at a lower price than the market. So they're getting internal lines of supply on food and energy. And that, of course, frees the People's Republic of China up to do many things in the Indo-Pacific in particular. And it limits India's capability to work with Russia against China and so on. There are many ramifications to this which are detrimental to the West. And I think Moscow couldn't believe that Washington would lure Russia into attacking Ukraine and then punish Russia so severely by driving it out of the global trading system, because that's so against Western interests and Western economies. And yet what we've seen is that the US, in order to punish Russia, has in fact punished itself. And of course, we see this as an interesting sideline to the build up to the U.S. midterm elections in November this year.
Let's go to the Indo-Pacific. Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We're headed to Australia. Gregory's native Australia, and how it now emerges from this conflict in Eastern Europe and this reawakening of NATO and this Cold War II before we have a bigger title for it. I'm John Batchelor.